89.3 4CRB.
And a very good morning to you. John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, back with you for another program of The Law and You. This is your opportunity to get free legal advice. All you need to do is get on that telephone as soon as you possibly can. 55208888 is the number. That number again, 55208888. And for those listening south of the Tweed River, of course, you'll need to put 07 in front of the number. But otherwise, throughout Queensland, you'll get straight through. 55208888. And certainly very quick out of the box this morning, we say a very good morning to Robert. G'day, Robert. How are you?
Good, John. Thanks for taking my call.
No trouble. How can we help?
Yeah, John, just wanted a bit of advice, if I could, please. Buying a property through a real estate agent, do they have to take the offer to on a contract to the vendor by law?
Well, I don't know whether they have to do that by law. But I mean, logic would dictate that they should do that, because otherwise they're not doing their job.
Yeah, I've asked, on two occasions, I've made an offer and they said the people wouldn't accept it. Then they rung me to say that the price had been reduced. So I made the same offer again, which is getting very close to it, and they, I said, I want to go to contract to make it transferable. And they will not take a contract to them.
Right,
I just wondered, where you stand that way.
Do you know the details of the seller?
No, they're across the other side of the country.
Okay, because if you were able to find out the details, it's not that difficult to do that.
No.
You could possibly ring the vendor direct and just say, look, I've been trying to put an offer to you and your agent is telling me they're refusing to communicate the offer. So I'm coming directly to you to let you know what the offer is.
Okay, I'll try that angle.
Because that might just, bring the agent into line. I think it is a bit rude on the part of the agent. It sounds to me like the agent knows that you want the property and therefore they're playing a bit of brinksmanship with you as well to try and frustrate you into increasing your offer. But, of course, what you offer for the property is entirely up to you. So
that's right.
So I presume then that you would be asking the agent to draw the contract?
Yes, I am.
Right, okay, because the other alternative would be to, if you were serious about it, would be to get the contract drawn by your solicitor and present that to the agent and say, and get your solicitor to tell the agent that they require them to put the offer to the seller.
Okay, well, I'll try that angle and see what happens.
Yeah, so there are just a couple of angles that might possibly help you with that bit of a problem. So good luck, Robert. And as I say, the other one, of course, would be if you could do a search and find out the details of the owner of the property and then communicate directly with them with your offer verbally over the telephone.
Yeah, I believe it is an estate matter, but anyway...
That might make it a little more complicated because then, of course, it's all well and good to know whose name is on the title, but if the person on the title is deceased, you've then got to know who the executor of the estate is to know who you've got to deal with. So that does... That does make it a little bit more of a problem.
Yeah, I'm only getting this information from the neighbours, so I don't know if it's fact or not, but anyway... I'll try the other angle first and I'll do a search and see what happens.
Yeah, well, the neighbours also might know not only the name of the owner of the property, but they, if they believe the person's passed away, they might even have details of who the executor under the will is.
Right, okay, I might get talking to them again.
So that might be a course of action that you can possibly follow that will help.
Yeah, all right, John. Thank you very much for that.
Okay, Robert.
Thank you very much.
All the very best. Okay. And the time on 4CRB is just coming up to 24 and a half minutes to 10. Of course, that's 24 and a half minutes to 11 south of the border. And a very good morning to all of our listeners from northern New South Wales. And a very good morning to Joyce. Good morning, Joyce. How are you today?
good morning.
How are you, Joyce?
Good, thank you. I would just like to ask, in the latest Women's Weekly, there's an article that says the Australian government have stopped doing discretionary trusts. Is that correct?
No, I unfortunately I don't read the Woman's Weekly, so I can't quote directly from the article. Comment on the article. What it may be is there was a suggestion by the Labor Party that if elected to government, they intend to tax discretionary trusts in a manner which will apply tax a discretionary trust in the same way that a company is taxed. So there'll be no ability to allocate income to student beneficiaries. The tax regime for trusts is already fairly onerous in that for many, many years, you have only been able to allocate, I think from memory, it's about $416 to an infant beneficiary before they're taxed at penalty rates. But if you have, for example, children who are students at university, and they're over 18, then it is possible to allocate income to them to lessen the overall burden, but I think, quite honestly, it's a bit of a ridiculous idea, for the simple reason that I think they will find that there will be a lot more people who will be penalised, and there'll be, with all of these things, unforeseen consequences. For example, a husband and wife can operate a business as a partnership. In more cases than not, one or other of them may play no part in the business at all, but from a tax perspective, they're still entitled to split the income equally between them as a partnership and return it legitimately, and that has been around for literally hundreds of years as a tax vehicle. In most cases, and particularly since the ability to allocate income to infant beneficiaries was removed, discretionary trusts really amount to basically, in most cases, the allocation of income between various members of the family. I think that the harm that'll be done by the change is probably greater than the reward to revenue that might be achieved.
Oh, I see. So it hasn't actually taken place yet.
I don't believe so. As I say, look, I haven't read the article in the Woman's
Weekly.
Well,
the article is about Michael Hutchins' legacy, and they're saying it was all in a discretionary trust, which the Australian government stopped doing.
Yes, well, I think the comment's wrong. Yes, well, look, it depends where his estate ended up. I know there has been a bit published about him in recent times.
Yes.
If you create a testamentary discretionary trust under your will, certainly the changes that the Labor Party are proposing to bring in at the next election will not affect testamentary discretionary trusts, according to material that I've seen published in the press as to what they're actually proposing to do. And there are also certain other discretionary trusts that they're saying won't be affected. It may be that Michael Hutchins' assets were all in a discretionary trust, which of course doesn't get the tax advantage treatment that a testamentary discretionary trust gets. So it's a bit of a complex area, and I think it's going to be one of those cases, Joyce, where you're simply going to have to watch this space and see what eventually arrives.
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
No
Thank
trouble.
You.
All the very best. And that probably leads on to a query that came up last week. I think it was from Josie, and that was for further comment in relation to the current survey that's taking place in relation to same-sex marriage and what a yes vote might mean in terms of legislation. As you probably know, there has been no draft legislation released as yet as to what that change might mean. But I think that the legislation where it will have probably its greatest effect is already in place, and that's the various pieces of anti-discrimination legislation that exist both federally and at a state level. And I think from memory there are actually about 13 separate pieces of legislation between the Commonwealth and the states that deal in this area. And I think that when and if the yes vote is successful and there is a change to the Marriage Act, if that were to occur, it will be more the ancillary legislation, amending legislation that may and probably will amend many of those current anti-discrimination laws, which will be the far more important ones that we'll need to be looking at, because the government has stated that you know, there will, it will not be an offence for someone to refuse to conduct a same-sex marriage on the basis of their conscience or religious beliefs, but there will be, I think, a lot of other areas where people will need to look very, very carefully at all the places where that type of discrimination could possibly occur unwittingly if the law is not also adjusted to ensure that that's the case. And you can, in fact, look around the world, and there has been a great deal of comment on the internet in relation to parents in other jurisdictions who have objected to certain teaching practices in under the state curriculum being imposed upon their children for religious reasons, and I'm aware of one issue in that respect in Canada where the government department's response basically was, well, if you don't want your child to be required to participate in this form of education, then you should enrol your child at a school that is exempt from it. And I think it appears to me from what I read that in Canada perhaps religious schools are exempt from those provisions, although that appears not to be the case in the United Kingdom, where there is a Jewish school that is under threat of closure for refusing to teach about same-sex marriage on religious grounds. I think it was under the Equality Act or something or other. That what it means for Australia is that if there is a yes result to the survey, and the government then proceeds, or the Parliament then proceeds to pass legislation to legalise same-sex marriage, people will need to look, and the parliamentarians will need to look very, very carefully at all of the areas where there will need to be amending legislation to make sure that unwittingly people who on a conscience basis may have objections are not subjected to prosecution or penalty because of their religious or moral beliefs. So it's going to be an interesting time if in fact that be the case. But enough of that. The time has just passed 15 minutes to 10. That's 15 minutes to 11 south of the border. The program is The Law and You. 5520888 is the phone number. If you have a question or a query that you would like answered today, please don't leave your questions to the last 5 or 10 minutes of the program. Last week we had a bit of a slow start and then a rush, and of course resulting in me needing to take a couple of calls off air at the end of the program. So if you do have a question or a query, get on that telephone right now. 5520888. We'll be back after this word from our sponsor.
It's no secret that the journey into aged care is a minefield. Getting help along the way can save you time, stress, and family drama. Kirsty from All Steps Aged Care is here to help you every step of the way. I help with planning your move, knowing how to pay for your care, understanding your options, and finding the right place to suit you. Call Kirsty, a sponsor of the station, on 0423 871 688.
4CRB Community Billboard.
U3A Twin Towns is offering a reduced rate of membership now of $40 for the remainder of 2017. Every Thursday, they hold classes in literature, poetry and plays. The group examines writing from renowned authors, old and new. phone 5534 7333.
Community Billboard on 4CRB is a free service for non-profit and charitable organisations. Each announcement must be forwarded to 4CRB at least 14 days before its broadcast. The wording for each announcement must not exceed 40 words. Email billboard@4crb.com.
And you're listening to The Law and You on 4CRB. Free legal talk back, your opportunity to get free legal advice. All we need you to do is get on that telephone as soon as you can. 5520888 is the number. That number again, 5520888. And as you know, one of the subjects that is very dear to my heart and which does concern me greatly is this growing trend of people making homemade and unusual wills. And there has been a case just this week or just last week in Queensland, Re-Nickel, which has revisited this whole issue where an unsent text message found on the mobile phone of a gentleman who had committed suicide has been admitted to probate as a will. Now, many of you may say, well, that's great that the law has permitted that, but the issue that really arises in relation to this is the unbelievable cost to the estate. And in that particular case, from memory, there were about four or five parties, and the court ordered that the costs of each party be paid out of the estate on an indemnity basis. Now, the estate did not appear to be large. The assets were relatively modest, and the tragedy of that is that the costs that would have been thrown away because of the person not bothering to make a proper will would be enormous. And I would venture to say in that matter, I would not be surprised if costs will account for probably 50% of the value of that estate. So the message that I'm giving to you today is whatever you do, take the time to spend the money and get a will properly made. But we have a few callers online and we say a very good morning to Eva. G'day, Eva. How are you today?
Good morning, yes.
How can we help?
Well, first of all, I'm interested about that unsent SMS message. Hmm. Couldn't anyone else just have gotten the phone and typed in a message? Because the phone doesn't say what time that got typed in. It might have been typed in after his death.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, Eva, but there were two issues that I think the court took into account, because judges certainly examine these matters very, very carefully and will not make those decisions lightly. And the interesting thing was that the phone was found by the de facto partner of the deceased and was handed over, and the message on the phone was seen by that person, and they were applying to the court on the basis of saying that this did not represent a will, but in fact that the deceased had died intestate or without a will, in which case the de facto partner would have taken a substantial share of the estate. And so therefore the person who discovered this message on the phone and handed it over was a person who had an interest in ensuring that that will did not exist and was not effective. So that was one of the major reasons why I think it was taken into account. And also they did have a forensic IT specialist who was able to approximate the time at which the message was typed into the phone and was able to show that it in fact was prior to the person's death.
Okay. My question is also about testamentary item.
Yep.
And I've got two friends, second marriages both, grown children both, not living with them, and the husband has said to the lady upon his death, she's going to have to pack up and go back to some Asian country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've been married like 3 odd years,
mm-hmm.
legally, in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And his daughter is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, do you know whether the wife has Australian citizenship?
Not citizenship, but she's permanent resident.
Permanent resident. Okay, well, look, no, I don't think that is necessarily correct. Depending on how the husband has his affairs ordered, certainly the wife would have a claim on his estate under the Succession Act, so she would be entitled to bring a provision, an application for provision out of the estate, which very well may include having a home provided for her. If the husband owns a house, she very well at the least may be given a life interest in that house and sufficient assets to live on. So I think that what I would be doing if I was your friend, I would be perhaps getting some legal advice herself in relation to the matter, and also considering whether, it may be a situation in which she needs to consider whether she should bring an application, separate from the husband and bring an application for property settlement. It's not a matter, obviously, on which I can give detailed advice, and she would need to see a lawyer who specialises in that area to get some advice. As a starting point, she could possibly go along to the Robina Community Legal Centre at the Gold Coast City Council Community Centre Robina, which operates on a Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. and get some preliminary free advice there, which might be able to steer her in the right direction. All right, then.
Thank you.
Okay, Eva, all the very best. And with the time just past 7 minutes to 10, 7 minutes to 11 south of the border, we say a very good morning to Claire. G'day, Claire. How are you? Claire, are you there?
Yes.
Hi,
yes.
Claire. How are you?
Good, thank you.
How can we help?
John, yes. My question is regarding a will.
Mm-hmm.
If one of your children's marriages fail, would the ex-partner have any claim against your estate?
The answer to the question, Claire, is it depends. So basically, if your will simply leaves your estate to your children outright, and you were to die, and then the marriage, a property application was brought, and the estate had been left to that child or part of it to that child, then the entitlement under the will would certainly be regarded as a matrimonial asset, which would come into the pool of assets to be considered as part of the divorce proceedings. If, on the other hand, the marriage failed and you're still hale and hearty, then it would be unlikely that that would come into account. Sometimes applicants in family law proceedings do try and bring in the assets of the parents and what the spouse might reasonably be entitled to receive out of the estate, but it can only affect the assets that are owned by the couple at the time of the application for, or the hearing of the application for property settlement. So in other words, it may be that a court may regard a potential inheritance as a financial resource going forward, which may affect how they'll deal with the assets that the couple actually own themselves. But certainly the court will not make an order that in any way says, well, the parents have got to give part of their assets to the spouse, to the husband or wife who's leaving.
Yes. All right. That's very good, John. That answers my question. Thank you very much.
Okay, Claire.
Thank you.
The very best. And the time on 4CRB is now approaching 4 minutes to 10. That's 4 minutes to 11. Daylight saving time, and we say a very good morning to Thomas. G'day, Thomas. How are you? Thomas, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm well indeed. How can I help you today?
The question is, a friend of mine and her husband have both received inheritances from their respective parents,
mm-hmm.
and both inheritances have been put into either one's personal account,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to their general combined mm-hmm. account. If they were to split, is there any claim on either way on those inheritances?
Well, it depends how long they've been together. So how long have they been together?
Oh, probably quite a few years now, 10 or 15 now.
Okay, so the mere fact that they've put the money into their individual accounts doesn't in any way protect it in terms of a property settlement application. But the but what will happen in the event that they did split up, certainly the court will take into account the assets that each of them have, but they will also, to a certain extent, take into account the contribution that each party has made to the marriage, and the fact that that money has been inherited would be a relevant factor. So you certainly can't say that the court would definitely not, for example, if one person had inherited $5 million and the other person inherited $10,000, and when they split, the needs of the person who got $10,000 were quite significant because they had health issues and all those sorts of things. Well, the court is certainly going to probably apply some of the money that has been inherited by the person who got the $5 million to the other party, so as to ensure that they can live a reasonable life, look after medical expenses in the manner that they would have been able to had the pair stayed together.
Well, there is a differential, but the differential is nowhere near that sort of figure.
I was pretty confident it wouldn't be, Thomas. I was just trying to use an extreme example, yeah.
But and the husband has kept the his inheritance separate and spent it and spent some of it, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
Their normal joint account, of course, and of course there'd be a property settlement on the house.
Yep.
But you say the wife's inheritance may or may not be taken into account.
Well, that's exactly right. The court, those assets would need to be disclosed to the court as part of any property settlement.
Right.
And the court will, and of course then it's a question of what claims each party make. I mean, you know, they may not want any of that money. They may not try to claim any of it. So that's the other side. And then lastly, if they do make a claim, well, then it's up to the court to decide what's reasonable for each party to receive, having regard to the length of the marriage, the contribution they've each made to the marriage, and the build-up of assets during the marriage. And bear in mind that inheritance is a windfall rather than contribution in building up assets. And so sure, that would be the result. But we'll have to leave it there, Thomas. We're just about to cross to news.
Thank you very much.
All the very best. John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, it's been great to be with you this morning. I'll certainly look forward to being back with you again next week for another program of The Law on You. So as always, until then, it's goodbye and God bless.